Support for this podcast of The Exchange is brought to you by the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity. And from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit DartmouthHitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Back in the summer of 2014, it was called the last stand of the middle class. And as the turmoil surrounding leadership of the Market Basket grocery store chain grew, it became clear that this standoff would make history. On the surface, the employee walkout looked like a worker strike from the golden era of organized labor. But in reality, it was a decidedly non-union protest of workers, managers, and customers. Finally, after 7 weeks of rallies, speeches, empty shelves, and a boycott, the movement achieved its sole demand, the reinstatement of ousted CEO and folk hero RDT Demoulas. Now, more than a year later, experts are still sorting out this saga's ramifications for big labor, employee relations, and corporate governance. Today in The Exchange, Market Basket, lessons from a grocery store drama through a brand new book and a forthcoming film. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have two guests for the hour with me in studio, Jay Childs, Portsmouth-based filmmaker and director of the forthcoming documentary called Food Fight, Inside the Battle for Market Basket. And Jay Childs, it's great to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Laura. Good to see you again, too.
Joining us from Philadelphia, Daniel Korshan, Associate Professor of Marketing at Drexel University and co-author of the new book, We Are Market Basket. And Daniel, good to have you, too. Thanks for your time.
Wonderful to be here.
Well, both of you, but Jay, to you first. Why was the whole region, all of New England, so captivated by this story?
I think, Laura, it's the, I put it, the audacity of it, the whole audacity of after years of people working in companies that start out a certain way and then maybe they get bought out or acquired and there's a new CEO or new leadership or a new board and people kind of lift their – I have clients who do this. You know, they lift their heads up for a moment and then they go, well, I don't – I've got a new email. I've got a new boss. I don't know who they are, but back to work. I still have a job and they don't really think about it even though – sometimes it turns out to be not that great for the employees and not that great for a larger, broader, you know, group of stakeholders. And here's a case where a company said, "No, no, we're not going to go along with that. We're not going to take that." And I think it's kind of, you know, it's that underdog approach, and the fact that they had the audacity to stand up, which I think is what something that a lot of people would like to be able to do. And it's also, you know, an incredible underdog story. And it's a story that doesn't just pit labor against management. It was labor, management, and a whole group of stakeholders all bonding together.
So a very different kind of protest.
That really resonated. It was wholly different than anything that we had really seen before. And we thought that at first, but then in the aftermath, a lot of experts and academics are saying, yeah, no, this really has not happened before like this.
Yeah, and I remember at the time, Jay, everybody saying, okay, you know, business professors, get out your pens and pencils. This is a case
study. We are in uncharted
territory.
That's
right. Daniel, what do you think? Why was the whole region of New England just drawn to this story?
Yeah, I mean, I think I would agree with a lot of what Jay said. What I would add is the fact that this company was already such a part of the fabric of the region. A lot of people didn't realize how important it was to them until this crisis and until they saw that it might be taken away. And so this, you know, it became a movement to save this institution that was really a deep part of many people's lives.
You know, Daniel, you've written about this. What language do you use, by the way, to describe this? Because the workers were quite clear, don't call this a strike.
That's right. Yeah, it's something I've never really found a perfect word for it. I mean, in the book we call it corporate disobedience. It's something similar to civil disobedience, but you're right. It's not a strike. It's not just a boycott. It was so many things put together that it's kind of hard to put your finger on it, but it's a very remarkable movement.
Corporate disobedience, although the corporation itself, meaning, you know, the board and the shareholders, they're not the ones being disobedient.
That's right. It's all the stakeholders. It was the employees, they who call themselves associates first. It's the customers, it's the suppliers, it's the community leaders. And that's really what drew me into this, is that it didn't fit into a strict labor story. A lot of people at first, they say, okay, here's just the strike. But I was really drawn because of how massive this movement was and how unified all these people who are normally have very different interests, right? Or we think of them as having really different interests. There was something that was unifying this group. And that really drew me in right away.
Our phone number here in The Exchange is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Today in The Exchange, we're looking back at the Market Basket saga from the summer of 2014, because there's a forthcoming film about this dramatic act that we saw in New England last summer, and there's a new book about it. The book is We Are Market Basket. The forthcoming film is called Food Fight. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. So, guys, we're going to talk a lot this hour about sort of what we learned and what people are still trying to figure out from this. But, Jay, just remind us what sparked this whole thing.
What sparked it was there's a board between the two factions of the company, or the two stake group of shareholders, what is conveniently called the Arthur T side and his cousin, the Arthur S side. And the board is made up of two people appointed by Arthur T, two people appointed by Arthur S, and three independents. They represent the nine shareholders within the company. One of the shareholders, family, an in-law, had been voting, was on Arthur S's side of the family, but had been voting with Arthur T's side of running the business. And in 2013, and we forget sometimes that this is really a two-year story or a story years in the making, she flipped her vote. So she decided that she was going to start voting with the Arthur S side of the board and their vision for the company. One side of the board was very active in the business day to day and saw a pattern of continued growth and continued reinvestment in the company. The other side really saw it more as an asset and wanted more dividends, more to gain more shareholder value for that for their stake in the company. And when she flipped, the board flipped, and new board members were appointed in the middle, and they started essentially acting in the interests of the Arthur S side. That led to the firing of Arthur T. Demoulas after a short period of time. And when Arthur T. Demoulas was fired, all hell broke loose.
Yeah, okay. So this source of dispute between RDT and his cousin Arthur S., I mean, out there among the protesters and the general public, Daniel Korshan, you know, RDT was sort of a man of the people, a folk hero. Arthur S. was sort of like, you know, Darth Vader, right? I mean, you know, corporate greed versus the regular Joe who's on your side. How accurate were those depictions? How fair were they, Daniel?
It's hard to say. I mean, I certainly don't, you know, I don't know what's in either of their heart. I can tell you based on their actions,
right,
my opinions. You know, I mean, from my standpoint and from the dozens, well, more than 100 certainly people that I've interviewed, it seems clear to me that the Arthur S. side was really very focused on pulling out all the liquidity of this company and selling it, and which would result in a big change in the company. And on the Arthur T. side, this is someone who loves the grocery business. There's no doubt about that, and had built this the company, continued the path that his father had set out, and grandfather for that matter, and put into practice a lot of programs and a philosophy of running the business that was trying to create a system where everybody else benefits as well as him. So it really became, he put into practice an idea that I teach in my classes, really, which is that the performance of the company is not necessarily the end goal. It's that you make sure that the company performs well so that it can grow and have a positive impact on all of those associates, on customers, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a very different way of doing business, of looking at what the purpose of a business is.
Well, and as Jay said, when employees found out that RDT had been pushed out by this new faction on the board, they were not happy, to say the least. In the Jay Childs film Food Fight, here's protest leader Tom Trainor describing the general feeling toward the new outsider management among longtime employees.
Everybody from the CEO on up, on down, has worked their way through the ranks, starting at the lowest levels. And these two people were from outside. We don't take direction from people outside. Just because the board gives them a CEO title, my boss is Arthur T. DeMolis. Always will be.
So that's the corporate disobedience that you talk about, Daniel Korshan. Go ahead.
That's right. Yeah, that's. I mean, from there, you can see that this company was not ready or willing or looking to take anyone from the outside. And this becomes a very big deal. I mean, just to give you one quick anecdote, there's an office in the corporate office. It's one of the choice offices. It has a really nice view compared to all the other offices in the front. It's kind of the center of the building, and that office is empty. It's vacant. It's vacant because it used to belong to Arthur T's father. There are actually two offices that are vacant like that. Another one. It belonged to Julie LaCourse, another legend in the company. And these offices have been kind of like retired, sort of the same way that you would retire the number of Bobby Orr or Larry Bird or something like that.
Really? Wow. Just leave it for posterity.
That's right. Yeah. So no one dares to go into those offices because it would feel like a breach of tradition, and it would feel disrespectful to those associates. So try to imagine now, like that sort of a culture that feels so strongly that you have to, you know, really earn your way up. And then these two CEOs are just, you know, appointed. So they take out this beloved CEO and appoint these other two CEOs to replace him. And you can imagine that they didn't have a very good, very auspicious start to their tenure.
Again, the phone number here in The Exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Here's a Facebook comment from Chris who says, if you treat employees well, you don't need unions. There are a lot of companies that claim to value employees, but the fact of the matter is it's not true. Market Basket, Chris says, shows that if you value your employees and treat them well, it will boost morale, decrease turnover, and maintain long-term employees. Two thoughts from that. I'll throw this to you first, Jay Childs. What about that second part that, you know, everybody says we value our employees, but not everybody walks the walk, so to speak?
No, and we tend to throw words around with companies like we're a family in this company, and that seldom plays out. All of these notions don't really play out a lot of the time. In this company, it's – you know, it's not just the moral desire to treat employees well, not just that, but it's been proven. And one of the people that we interviewed at MIT, Zeynep Ton, wrote a book called The Good Job Strategy, that you can actually expect a lot more out of employees by treating them well. So, yes, you're giving them the dignity of a secure lifestyle and possibly a secure retirement. But you can also expect a lot of them. And one of the themes that they didn't want to have lost over all of this was this idea that, you know, Arthur T. DeMolis isn't just out there cutting bonus checks and taking care of everybody without expecting something. And he expects them people to work very hard. And sometimes you work holidays and sometimes you're asked to go above and beyond and you don't question it. But it's because that investment has been made in their welfare and in giving them a secure, dignified job, that they'll do that for them. So it's the right thing to do, but it also pays dividends in terms of productivity and in terms of, as we saw, loyalty. I mean, I've never seen loyalty to a single individual in my life that I saw was being shown to this person.
What about the first part of Chris's Facebook comment, Daniel Korshan? If you treat employees well, you don't need unions. This was a big part of the story that the Market Basket workers, right, Daniel, were very clear that we are not unionized. We don't want to be unionized. We just want RDT back.
Yeah, in fact, my understanding is that some unions called them up, asked them, you know, do you need some help? And they said, you know, we're doing just fine on our own. In my view, I think that had unions been part of the picture, it would have been more difficult to pull this particular protest off because, you know, here you have management and workers working together, really, you know, in unison, completely cohesive, right? And in the unions, very often what we see is there's a sort of natural fault line that develops between the workers on the one side and management on the other. And I think in this particular case, that dynamic would have been a bit disruptive. If I could add, I just want to add one other thing to what Jay was mentioning before also that I'd like to echo is this idea that this is not a company that's giving anything away to employees. I think we call it in the book reciprocal loyalty because it's not there's actually a big debate in the academic literature about, you know, how much should you be hard on employees and try to, you know, squeeze as much as you can out of them? How much should you just give them as much as possible and hope that something good is going to happen? And this company, it works more in the middle where it just, when an employee comes in and they're pushing carriages or bagging groceries, they're expected to earn their keep and give a little something. And then what the company does, and this is Arthur T., but the rest of the management team, they act so consistently. Is that they just continue to ratchet it up, and they'll give you like a little bit more than you're putting in. So as you give more, they give you just a little bit more. And associates that we've spoken to, they sort of have this mental account, right, where they say, here's everything that I've put in, and here's everything that the company has given back to me. And so many associates, they say, I'm just a little bit behind on that account. I got to give a little bit
really?
More. And then they I think this is a sort of mental account that everybody keeps. But in this is one case where so many associates they say I'm just a little bit behind. I need to give a little bit more. And so the company is it's giving in this way, but it's not just giving away the store as we've heard some other. If you may recall, there was a company in California that gave everybody a raise to $70,000 a year or something like that, right? That's not the way that Market Basket operates. They ratchet it up over time, and it's a give and take, and you end up with this a long-term sort of negotiation is not quite the right word, but it's something along those lines where they're saying we owe each other.
Go ahead, Jay.
Two quick points following up what you said about point one about the non-union nature of this. It was very funny. One of the labor historians that we spoke with said that was part of the reason they won was there was no script. And as he put it, there was no ring. There were no three-minute rounds. There was no referee. There was no series of events they had to follow, which commonly happens in a union dispute. So they didn't have to play by any rules that had been laid out. And the fact that they really weren't organized that way, there's some humorous things that came out of it. One of them was the first couple of days, if you imagine the headquarters, there's two entrances to the parking lot. And most people were just standing off the property on the grass holding banners protesting. And it was actually a police officer who said, you know, I've worked union strikes before. You can actually circle around and block the entryways, and when a truck goes to leave, what they called a scab truck, you can walk three times before you have to let that truck come out.
So the police officer gave them advice on how to
conduct
this?
So the police officer was just saying, just so you know, you can walk in a circle and picket. Like you can actually – and they're like, oh – and they said, and you can block a truck three times and then you have to get out of the way. That's how it works. Well, they didn't know that. And so all of a sudden they were like, oh, that's a good – so they set up these two picket lines around each entrance. So the fact that there weren't these hard and fast rules about how this was going to go gave them the freedom to act in a way that, you know, the board and the new CEOs had no idea what they were going to do next in a way.
Well, that was a sense that you got during this whole thing, too, is that the new management was kind of floored by this, right, Jay? I mean, they didn't react well. They didn't really have the PR game down very well.
No, and that was to me, that was one of the key things. Joe Schmidt took very early on, I believe, and I could be wrong, it was actually before Arthur T. was fired, to the radio and grabbed the narrative and told the story of why everyone had a stake in this dispute resolving for Arthur T. Demoulas.
All right. We'll follow up after a short break and take your phone calls, questions, comments, thoughts, 1-800 892-6477. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, a look back at the Market Basket Standoff of 2014 with a new book on the subject and a forthcoming film. The book is called We Are Market Basket, co-authored by one of our guests, Daniel Korshin, Associate Professor of Marketing at Drexel University. The film is called Food Fight, Inside the Battle for Market Basket. And Portsmouth-based filmmaker and director Jay Childs is with me in studio. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Daniel and Jay, let's go right to our listeners. Sheila's in Concord. Hi, Sheila. Go ahead. You're in The Exchange. Welcome.
Hi. We never shopped at Market Basket before the strike. But since then, we've been shopping there because we supported the struggle. So I'm wondering if our if we are similar to other shoppers, if there's been an increase in shoppers, and if the profits have gone up since the struggle ended.
Okay. Thank you very much for calling in. So actually, Daniel, an incentive for people to shop there who didn't shop there before.
That's right. I've heard about this from a lot of people who, you know, they witnessed this and they said, "What is going on over there? What is this magic that I'm seeing in Market Basket?" And so they did bring in a lot of shoppers. So they had everyone returned and then plus some, and I think a lot of them for the same reasons that that Sheila mentioned, which is that they, you know, they saw something there, something in this culture that they responded to. It's a very distinctive kind of a company, so it's not. It's not the supermarket for everyone. It's a certain type of shopping that they're looking at, but it's but a lot of people respond very strongly to it.
Do you want to jump in there, Jay?
Yeah, and very interestingly, you know, Sheila represents something that's wholly unique to this story that I've never encountered before, both for the book and the film. That you have, you know, normally a documentary film is about something fascinating that happened to other people somewhere else. And in this case, between the 25,000 associates and about 2 million customers, you have people like Sheila who were characters in this drama, who played an active, functional role in determining the outcome of how this happened. So when they see the film or they read the book, they're seeing their own role in how they brought about, you know, this resolving itself the way that it did. So there's so many people who didn't just watch this happen but actually participated in what happened.
Well, and speaking of how customers responded, including new customers like Sheila, NHPR's Rick Ganley spoke with Market Basket Operations Manager Joe Schmidt on Morning Edition a couple months ago. And Rick asked Joe Schmidt how sales have been in the year since the protest. Let's hear.
This year, we're looking at approximately $4.8 billion in sales, comparative to last year, around $4 billion. And so it's just a good indicator to show that, you know, not only do we have our existing customers that have come back, but we have new customers that are shopping with us now because they wanted to see, you know, what is Market Basket all about? And it's our job to continue to show them our low price structure and take care of them with good service.
Again, the phone number here in The Exchange, 1-800-892-6477. We're looking back at lessons learned from the whole Market Basket drama in the summer of 2014. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Sheila, thanks for that call. And let's go to Mount Vernon, and Tim is on the air. Hi, Tim. Go ahead.
Good morning, folks. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Not to reiterate what you've already covered, but this Market Basket saga is historic, economically historic territory. It's what it is. It's a throwback. There's a guy named Milton Friedman, Chicago School of Economics, and he basically years ago changed the whole nature of the American corporation. The American corporation used to take an interest in all the stakeholders. In other words, the employees, community it was in, and the future of its business. Milton Friedman changed the way corporations look at their existence, and they became solely a function of profit for the shareholder. The other stakeholders got run out of the equation. No longer did they care about the employees. No, they became expendable. No longer did they care about the community, and no longer did they care about generally long-term growth. So what you have with this market basket saga is a rebellion against current corporate
sort of an older philosophy prior to Milton Friedman. Now, Daniel, I think you've written about this. Just remind us what Tim's talking about there.
Oh, this comes up in my research all the time. In the 70s, Milton Friedman wrote an op-ed in the New York Times that, as Tim said, has been unbelievably influential in business and the way people see business. And the way that I describe it is that he really brought up the idea that shareholders, there's a commitment that the company has to make to shareholders, obviously. They put in capital into the business that's absolutely critical. And the board, part of their responsibility is to look after those shareholders and to make sure that that the CEO and other stakeholders aren't, you know, doing any funny business with that money, right? He pointed that danger out, and it's been really the focus of a lot of research and attention since then. And it's turned into this idea where now shareholder value for many people has become the only thing that the board should be doing. And I think what we see here, and Tim rightly points it out, that the board's responsibility is even legally, not just ethically, is much broader than that. And there are many dangers the other way. And when shareholders are given too much power in this equation, they can change companies drastically, and not always for the good. This is a case where I think there was a company that things by all measures was working very well, very successful. People were happy with the culture. Many people, 2 million people in the region were benefiting from this thing, and the board put so much emphasis on the shareholders at the expense of these other ones that this crisis happened.
As a matter of fact, yeah. Dan found out through the research that it really was a myth, this idea of shareholder super priority. And it's still in the definition, Dan, right, of corporations in Massachusetts and other states, that the definition of the corporation and its obligation is to a multi-pronged group of stakeholders, including the community, employees, customers. So this idea that kind of one group was siphoned off may have happened in practice, but it never was true in by definition, correct?
Yeah, that's right, Jay. In the corporate code in Massachusetts, and it's the same way in most states, the foremost scholar on this is Lynn Stout. She's at Cornell Law. She's looked at the corporate code in every state in the country, and there isn't any that says it's only shareholders if you look in the corporate code. It's really pretty amazing. It's been eye-opening for me to see that, because I was taught in my undergrad, in my MBA program, in my doctoral programs, that shareholders have to come first, and it is, as Jay said, it's a myth.
Well, have things really changed at other companies, Daniel? It's been a year and a half, and you're right. Back at the time, a lot of people said what Tim says and what you guys are saying, that, shareholders need to realize it's not just about them. The company would be more successful if all the stakeholders, not shareholders, but stakeholders, are happy. But has anything really changed at other companies in terms of their thinking around this?
Yeah, it's hard to put your finger exactly on how this is happening. I mean, I think just the fact that we have this film and hopefully the book and other case studies that are coming out on this, that this idea is going to start to trickle out and affect people, and I think, return us to more of a balance. But we are seeing, there are many cases nationally where people are starting to recognize this. Hillary Clinton now is using some of the practices at Market Basket, and especially profit sharing, in her stump speech. The Secretary of Labor has said that this story captured a nation, and that the nation is proud of Market Basket. And the Boston Globe says that it's upended conventional wisdom. So, I mean, I think we're starting to see some subtle, some moves and increased attention to these sort of ideas. So I'm very happy that this points us in what I consider to be the right direction.
Also, afterwards, Dan, We went down with a group from Market Basket. The Secretary of Labor did a national press club speech.
It's the U.S. Secretary of Labor?
Yes.
Wow.
Primarily targeted to Market Basket. And after, held a roundtable discussion with his advisors, his economists, and about five or six people from Market Basket, talking about what can we learn and how can we implement what you did to spread the word to other businesses that this is in the interest of everyone. Also, Dan went over with two Market Basket people to give a talk at Oxford University over in the UK. So there was great international interest in what some of the lessons for business would be.
I did not know that. All the way to the UK and the Secretary of Labor and presidential candidates and so forth. Well, one of the elements that also attracted a lot of people was the role of the customers and how some longtime Market Basket customers boycotted the store once they saw how upset the employees were. Let's hear again. This is a piece from Jay's forthcoming film, Food Fight. This is Steve Polenka. He's one of the leaders of the protest movement. He says when customers joined the protests, it was a game changer.
They didn't get involved because they were trying to save a few cents on a can of peas. They didn't get involved because Steve Polenka asked them to get involved. They got involved because of the cashier on register 2 that they use every Tuesday morning at 9:45. The kid in the deli department who knows Mary will take her pre-sliced cheese, but you damn well better cut the ham thin as you can be.
Again, that's a clip from Jay Child's forthcoming movie called Food Fight. It's about Market Basket. And Jay, just remind us what a big deal this was, this customer response.
Oh, and how it grew sort of organically. They began by having at stores, having people sign petitions. So have customers sign petitions to have Arthur T. reinstated. But the message early was we're not going to be getting as much product as we used to, and we apologize that, you know, produce and dairy are going to start to run out. We're going to do the best that we can. And through this process of customers learning about the story, again, grabbing that narrative and putting it out there, Jim Fantini, who was one of the leaders of the rebellion, said, you know, we were just telling customers, support us, but we didn't really know how that was. And it was the customers who finally, after learning this, said, I know what we'll do. We're not going to shop there anymore until he comes back. And
they would take their Hannaford's receipts and stick them on Market Basket.
And they would protest.
Remember that?
Yes,
yeah.
And they would protest by saying, this is how much I'm having to spend at other stores by not being able to shop at Market Basket. So once that began to take off, then you had the rallies, and that's where the clarion call went out through the broadcast media and the rallies. Please go somewhere else. Please shop somewhere else until this is resolved.
Let me push back a little bit, though, with you, Jay, and you, Daniel, on this idea of a boycott. I mean, pretty quickly into this, there was nothing really to buy at Market Basket anyway. So if they don't have, you know, lettuce and milk, am I boycotting them or am I just saying I need lettuce and milk?
You certainly couldn't buy all of your groceries there. You know, in the perishables areas, there was nothing. Those areas were completely decimated. The paper products, there were still enough that you could do a fair amount of your shopping. So this was, in my mind, there was a conscious decision by people that they did not want to shop there.
And you have a very good point by pushing back. What we've found out and what we've been told in our reporting is that even when that began and the shelves began to empty, there were replacement drivers and there were replacement warehouse workers who were brought in to with the idea through the CEOs that if we just can restock, even partially restock the stores, customers will come back. They're not shopping there because there is very little to buy. And it took a long time for them to realize that they could do all the attempts to restock that they wanted to. The customers were just not going to come back no matter what. And then the suppliers stopped supplying, so there was nothing to supply. So that was the loudest clarion call that even if you restock all of these stores, these customers are not coming back until it's resolved the way they wanted to. And, you know, many of the people associated with the rebellion, just they call them the closers. The customers were the closers. They were the ones who came in.
They sealed the deal.
They sealed the deal.
Well, and we'll talk about the suppliers and the distribution network in a minute, gentlemen, because that's an important point, Jay. I'm glad you brought that up. But let's go back to our listeners. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And to Jennifer in Hanover. Hi, Jennifer. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome.
Yes. Good morning. Thank you. I was just curious to hear the guests' thoughts on the role they think social media might have played in this dispute, and specifically sort of uniting all the stakeholders and getting the message out on what to do, and whether or not they think this would have played out the same way in the absence of social media.
Interesting question, Jennifer. Do you know Dan?
Yeah, I mean, the social media played a very big role. It's I think first it helped inform people very quickly. So in 2013, when this crisis started to bubble up, and there was an initial threat to Arthur T, where he was going to be fired by the board, they called, you know, hundreds of people, and it happened very quickly. They were able to assemble people. There were online petitions as well, and then throughout the thing, it really became a way to keep people connected from all different walks of life. And this is not a company that has a lot of technology in that sense. Like the company itself does not have a Twitter account or even a website, for that matter.
I remember that somebody had to make one, right? Like
loyal customer came up with their own website because they wanted to make the circulars available to people. So it's not a company. It's a company that really focuses on very personal one-on-one interactions. But they knew that everyone was on social media and that this was going to be the best way to rally them. So it did play a very, very important role.
The protesters had an active Facebook page, right? We Are Market Basket, something like
that,
Daniel?
They had a blog that was called We Are Market Basket, and they had a Facebook page, Save Market Basket, and you know, dozens of others that were sort of the, I don't know if it's right to call them the unofficial ones, but other associates, other customers, they started their own Save RDT. They all had their own names. But yeah, and they were all connected. So it became a way for people to talk to each other, to express their concerns. And most of all, to inform people and respond to announcements that the CEOs and the board, in some cases, were making over that year and couple months.
Well, Jennifer, thank you for the question. And it's bringing up aspects of this story that I had forgotten about. So thank you. Let's go to Tanya in Bedford. Hi, Tanya. Go ahead. You're in the Exchange. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I'm on my cell phone, so I hope you can hear me okay. We're one of those loyal Market Basket shopper families, and we boycotted. We would, you know, drop off donuts and coffee to our local store. We would, like, walk through our local store and look at the food that we would have bought if we weren't boycotting. I forced my kids to go to a rally in Tewksbury.
Wow.
My teenage son made a sign that said, I didn't want to be here, but my mom said it was a workers' rights issue, so she made me.
You're serious, Tanya.
I love my Market Basket. And I just wanted to push back on a few of the comments that your panel has made. And I did buy the book, by the way. When you said that Market Basket is a shopping experience, I think you said for a certain type of shopper, it doesn't appeal to everyone. I mean, you can get ramen noodles in bulk, but you can get fancy cheeses from France. You know, you can get Market Basket eggs, or you can get cage-free organic there. It's just, it is an amazing supermarket. It's an amazing experience, amazing employees. And it's just, it's not like your grandfather's Market Basket anymore. It's not the Market Basket that we remember from the 70s and the 80s.
Okay. Well, Tanya, thank you very much for calling in. We appreciate it.
Yeah, I think she makes a good point. This is Daniel again. They do have tremendous variety. A lot of it, they have a lot of local products that they offer. The one thing that I would say is that this is more of a weekly sort of family shopping experience, and that was what I was getting at, where a lot of other supermarkets are going more towards very small, sporadic kind of shopping over the week. Market Basket has maintained that family shopping.
All right, and thank you again for the call, Tanya. We'll be back in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, what we learned from the Market Basket Battle of 2014 through a new book and a forthcoming film. The book is called We Are Market Basket. Co-author Daniel Korshin is with us. The forthcoming film is called Food Fight, Inside the Battle for Market Basket. And the filmmaker, Jay Childs, is with us as well. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.com. Marketbasket.org. And Jay Childs, a little bit ago, you said that the customers joining this boycott or walkout or whatever you want to call it was sort of the, well, it sort of was the game, the closer, the thing that really sealed the deal. Early on, though, the thing that really made this difficult for management was the suppliers, the distributors. Remind us of the beginning of the chain there.
Yes. So the companies, and again, these are in many cases long-standing, multi-decade relationships between suppliers and vendors and Market Basket. And at a certain point, they stepped forward for a couple of reasons. One, they were like, we're a part of this too. We're a stakeholder too. So we're not going to do business with you anymore. We're not going to supply you anymore. There will be nothing to put into the warehouse until this is resolved. The other reason was in their bookkeeping, you know, with basically everyone in the office gone, checks, odd checks were going out to different vendors and suppliers. They were being underpaid for something, overpaid maybe for something that, you know, and that was also kind of a point where they were like, we don't know what's going on in there, so we're just going to step back and not supply.
It's too complicated.
So it was both sort of a connection to what was going on and the fact that the company, they were suspect about how the whole company was being run without people in the office to man it. So and then it spread from there. But it also took quite a toll on a number of the vendors. You know, small bread vendors, small flour vendors, mums were being grown. Tens of thousands of mums for the fall season were being grown.
Right, because this happened over the summer.
With nobody to buy them. And so
because you'd already signed your contract, I will sell these mums to Market Basket.
And there was a, you know, some businesses were threatened. And the governors got involved, especially here in New Hampshire. The New Hampshire governor got involved because when the part-timers were laid off as a result of this, there was a chance that thousands of people were going to end up on the unemployment rolls filing for unemployment. So there were ancillary or there were actually, you know, real stakeholder potential consequences and calamities to this that were very real. So the vendors both helped out and suppliers by not supplying product, but a lot of them, the smaller ones especially, were really taking a hit in terms of their business. Some of these vendors and suppliers, 80% of their business is Market Basket.
Wow. Okay. So when 80% of your business is in chaos, what do you do with all that fresh fish you have or all the chicken or whatever?
Exactly.
Yeah, that stuff doesn't keep. So, well, here's a little bit again from your film, Jay. Shortly after the removal of RDT as CEO, protest leader Tom Trainor said that the protest organizers met and thought really hard about the best way to shut down the company. Let's hear.
We decided that the best way to do this would be to shut down distribution and store support, which meant everybody in the office and all of the warehouses. And in that way, you would still have the stores open. They would still be getting a paycheck. You would affect the least amount of people, yet do the maximum amount of damage.
The maximum amount of damage, again, that's protest leader Tom Trainor in the forthcoming film about Market Basket called Food Fight. You know, Daniel, from a business professor perspective, I'd love your thoughts, too, on just sort of, you know, starting at the beginning there, those distributors, those suppliers, and how they all reacted and participated in this.
Yeah, well, there are the warehouse associates who were part of Market Basket, employees of Market Basket. I think they, in my view, took the biggest step, the biggest risk. And this is something that, you know, we tend to overlook because it is an uplifting story, especially now in hindsight. You know, we tend to look at the fun moments and the nice, but there was a tremendous amount of uncertainty. I mean, there was a real risk that this entire chain was going to close down and possibly never open again.
Wow.
There were some very scary moments for people, and the people that really, I think, at the center of it were the warehouse employees who did not have an enormous paycheck. I mean, they get paid well compared to other companies, but their paychecks are not that large, and they walked off and said, we're going to sacrifice that. So many of them took on their own personal credit card debt. Some of them, you know, they were struggling to make ends meet, calling local banks and credit unions, trying to make sure that they could pay their bills and things. So they took just a tremendous risk And as Jay, you know, and you see this actually in Jay's film, you see some of the scenes that I've seen. It really comes across how strongly people felt and how committed they were to this, that they were really willing to sacrifice. And just very quickly, there were a lot of associates at Market Basket have multiple people in the family who work at Market Basket. So there's the head of accounts payable. She has some people working at the store. She's got cousins. She's got other family members. So they're really like as their own personal family. They're walking out in support because they feel so strongly that they don't want to see this institution go away.
Well, what did those folks do, Daniel? You know, the farmer who's growing the mums back in the spring and summer for fall sale. The guy who's got 100 pounds of fish that he was hoping to sell to Market Basket. He's got the contract, and now the fish is starting to go bad. I mean, what did those people do?
Mostly they scrambled. They looked for other outlets. They would sell. For some of those types of products, they have auctions where you can sell, but it's, you know, they'll get a fraction of what they normally would get if they sold directly to Market Basket. So for the most part, they scrambled and took a hit and hoped for the best.
Let's take another call, gentlemen. And Paul joins us from Portsmouth. Hi, Paul. Go ahead. You're in the Exchange. Welcome.
Yes, good morning. I've read Dan's book, and what intrigues me as someone who has some experience in corporate governance is how the third generation of the Demoulis family, who had seen the company build in the way that it had done and understood its, or should have understood its ethos, could have ever imagined that they would have been successful, and particularly when they go and appoint a pair of CEOs who don't even come from this part of the country. What due diligence did those CEOs did before they accepted the job? It just strikes me as an astonishing dereliction of duty. And although you weren't able to get a straight answer from them when you wrote your book, I'm wondering if you've had any subsequent information as to any feedback from those two individuals and as to why on earth they accepted the job in the first place.
Well, it's a good question, Paul, and I'll throw it to both of you. But since he directed it to you, Dan, first, go ahead.
Sure. I can tell you that I just tried to contact Felicia Thornton 2 or 3 days ago. I haven't heard back from her, but I did ask her things along those lines. Were you prepared? Did you know, did the board prepare you for what you were getting into? So I haven't heard back. I'm not expecting to hear back, but you never know. I'm hopeful to hear what her perspective on things. But the third generation aspect that you're saying as well, I mean, this is it's not uncommon, as everyone knows, that you get into these family disputes in different ways. I think what's unusual here is how starkly different each side was, and how toxic this feud became.
Do you want to jump in, Jay?
Yeah, I think a lot day to day, a lot of the vitriol was directed at these two new CEOs, basically for what they represented. But the real anger was for the board who had put these people in, and Joe Schmidt had mentioned. He said, "I would have had respect for these CEOs, more respect, if they had walked in, seen what the reaction was, and went back to the board and said, I didn't sign up for this, you know, and left. But the problem was they stayed. And
yeah, and that's Paul's question. What were they thinking?
I put a call in too, a couple calls in to Felicia Thornton. And why is it that knowing that they stayed? The other angle that we've learned from the board member who we've been able to interview, who was with the old board, the board during the strike, and now is still with the board, was that very early on, he's confirming for us that very early on, the A shareholders, the Arthur S side shareholders, recognized that these two new CEOs were not going to be able to get the company back up and running. And so what do you do? So whatever they saw, it was just there were emails back and forth between the stores and mostly Felicia Thornton. And she was very polite, and she just stuck to her theme, which is we need to operate this company for the customers, and we need to stock it, and the customers will come back, and everything will be fine, and never really budged from that narrative.
Well, and in a way, maybe she thought, you know, people are upset. I understand that. I respect that. But it'll die down, and eventually people will have to come back to work.
The consequence of that was that we found out that really at the end of the sixth week, It wasn't a matter of really the agreement coming together between the two sides. This board member was concerned that the banks were walking away. They were not going to be able to get financing even if they did come together, because the belief was you cannot turn off a company and then just turn it right back on again. Though people kind of knew that the minute things were resolved, the warehouse was going to get going, the customers were going to come back, but you can't represent that very easily to banks. So it really was truly on the precipice of almost becoming insolvent and no agreement working for either side.
Yeah, that's interesting. And we didn't even talk about the banks and their role. So glad you brought that up, Jay. Here's an email from Eric in Mount Vernon, who says, during the protests, I remember there being a counter narrative. The story was that RDT was no prince. Could you please comment on that? Daniel, any thoughts? I mean, nobody's perfect.
Sure. Yeah. And I don't think that that he would say he was perfect either. What I usually focus on is his management practices and what he did. So I see a lot to admire there. I think that he is someone who truly does care about the people working there and the customers. And as I said before, you know, I can't say what we haven't met him personally. I haven't. And he doesn't like to talk about this protest at all. But I can only tell you what I see from what he does. And I think there's a lot to admire in his management practices.
Well, OK, so here's another email. Thank you, Eric, for that one. Here's another one that asks more about the management and so forth. This is Jerry in North Sutton, who says, yes, the Market Basket story is unusual and visible because so many people are customers. But Jerry says, compare management employee relations at Market Basket with the no controversy, high loyalty story at Hypertherm, employee owned, high tech firm in Lebanon. Now, Daniel, you're not a New Hampshire guy right now, although you've lived in New Hampshire. Right. Jerry's right. Hypertherm is employee owned. So that's another management strategy.
Yes, we interviewed an analyst who owns a company that helps companies work with companies to transfer into employee ownership. And, you know, to him, that's kind of the golden, the holy grail of how a lot of companies could work.
Because then you've really got a stake.
The way he defines this is he says, you know, these associates at Market Basket were acting as owners because of their loyalty, because of their bonuses, because of their profit sharing, which is really an outlier from how we do things today. And he suggests that, you know, the next step would be, if they really wanted to codify this, if they wanted to formalize it, would be to turn this into an employee-owned company. Now, the employees don't seem to be calling for that because they're treated just fine the way they are as they go into another generation. But, you know, Hypertherm is an example of that next step.
Let's take another call. That's this right. Is Richard in Concord. Go ahead, Richard. You're on the exchange. Welcome.
Well, thank you. Now, I have another aspect to present here about the Market Basket debacle. Now, I'm an elderly person who lives in Havenwood retirement community. And a number of years ago, 7 or 8 years ago, I guess it was, I was in Market Basket down on Fort Eddy Road, and I had a seizure.
Yikes.
And someone noticed it, and within moments, the store manager, Mr. Ricci, came up, seated me, took all of my groceries, which I had purchased, called somebody, had them checked out for me, then got on the phone and got a young man and an older man. They both had to drive, and they brought me home, put me in their car, brought me home. And before they did that, they sent the young guy out to get my car, move it, bring it up next to the building, park it, lock it. And another gentleman, the older gentleman with a big car, came up and they got me, took me out to the car, put me in, brought me back to Havenwood, brought me into my cottage, got me seated comfortably, then called the medical authorities who came and got me, and didn't leave until I was absolutely safely taken care of. And
now,
I thought,
that is amazing. Richard, what about the groceries?
Oh, they brought them home for me.
I was hoping you'd say that.
Absolutely.
Thank you for calling, Richard. That's great. Talk about customer service, Daniel. Wow.
Oh yeah, that's something. What they preach at this company is that they should have exceptional service while they have those low prices, and it comes down to personal interactions, one-on-one. They believe very strongly in that. I think it's the way to garner this kind of support, and to get back to, if I could just very quickly get back to the previous caller as well. The idea of employee ownership. There are so many ways to achieve these kind of goals. I think what every company wants to do is to have companies where you have this sort of loyalty, cohesiveness, that sort of family atmosphere. There are many ways to do it. I think employee ownership is one way. Market Basket has found another way, which I think can be, you know, mm-hmm. yet another model for good high performance companies that are also good for the community and the people that they work with.
Well, last question for you, Jay Childs. I did want to ask you very briefly about the political involvement of both the governors of Massachusetts and New Hampshire getting involved in this. How come they got involved, and what kind of impact did that have?
Well, from what we know, and I can't speak for them, of course, but we were able to interview Governor Hassan. I think what spurned it was this idea that all of these part-time people were going to be laid off. The CEOs didn't call it laid off. They called it not scheduling hours.
But they weren't getting checks. So.
But there was the possibility of that of a lot of unemployment insurance having to go out. Governor Hassan got a little more involved than Deval Patrick did because one of the law office that basically represented Arthur S.'s shareholders was – his wife was part of that.
Oh, I had forgotten
about
that.
So he was a little
right.
hamstrung in the way that he was able to get involved. And a lot of people didn't take too kindly to some of the comments he made, which was basically get back to work and then resolve this. But Governor Hassan, it is believed that she rolled up her sleeve and did play a role in helping to mediate between these two. And this is a company where a lot of the people who led the rebellion are not ideologically aligned, we would say, with Governor Hassan, but did give her credit for her role in this.
Okay. Both of you, thank you very much for being with us. Daniel Korshan, good to have you. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's a real privilege to be on the show and great to be able to tell this story of so many New Englanders.
Daniel Korshan is co-author of the new book, We Are Market Basket. Jay Childs, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much, Laura.
Jay Childs, Portsmouth-based filmmaker, author of the forthcoming film, Food Fight, Inside the Battle for Market Basket. This is The Exchange on NHPR.